at CIUT 89.5 FM. Today we're going to be speaking to Vanessa Beely, 21st Century Wire, who's written so many great articles about the war in Syria, or I should say the war against Syria, and her exposure of the phony white helmets has been outstanding work. Vanessa, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you so much for having me back on, Phil. Always a pleasure.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you what sparked my urge to talk to you today. It seemed very significant to me. You have a great Twitter account. I urge people to go Vanessa Beely Twitter, because you know the quicker we can be informed, the better. But one of your correspondents was sending out basically under the title Good News or Great News, and saying that we are seeing the winding down and the completion of the war against ISIS with, I guess, on the verge of complete success. And I want to ask you, does this mean, is that accurate? And is the territorial integrity of Syria basically guaranteed at this point? What do you think?
No. I mean, I would not go so far in any stretch of imagination to say that the territorial integrity is guaranteed at this point, because we still have various fracture points left, or pivot points left inside Syria itself. What it is the final, the final battle, the mother of all battles, as it was described, against ISIS, so against Daesh, who were occupying, obviously, Deir ez-Zor, Raqqa, and then up to the Iraqi border. And basically, a contingent of the Iraqi Hashid al-Shaabi Brigade, the PMUs, had entered Syria from the Al-Qaim border, where, of course, they had also, in Al-Qaim, they had just defeated Daesh in Iraq, and they had assisted the Syrian army in dislodging the final enclave of Daesh terrorists from Al-Bukamal city on the border between Iraq and Syria. So to a large extent, the backbone of what we can describe as international terrorism has been broken, but we still have pockets. For example, in Idlib, you have now what is effectively the hub of Al-Qaeda, you know, despite all the various rebrandings, whether it's Hariri Tahrir al-Sham, whether it's, you know, HTS. I mean, the branding is very deceptive, and I would also urge people not to kind of make this differentiation between Daesh, Al-Qaeda, and all the other various factions like Northern Zinki, like Ar-Sham. There's a multitude of them, Jaish al-Islam, for example, because in reality, the financing, the support, and the backing of these groups comes from within the coalition that has been trying to destabilize Syria. And whatever the nomenclature of those groups, their ideology is very much the same. There is very little infighting between them except over territory or over equipment or over armament, for example, over supplies.
And when they get close together, they suddenly cooperate, don't they?
I mean, we've seen this also in the northeast, for example, and in the relinquishing of territory that was held by Daesh to the U.S.-backed SDF or the YPG, 80% SDF, which is the Syrian Democratic Forces, which is comprises 80% YPG, so Kurdish factions, that many of which are pushing for federalization within Syria, the creation of the state of Kurdistan within Syrian territory. So there is still a degree of risk from those factions of a demand for the breaking down of Syrian territorial integrity. Although we're seeing, in the last couple of days, we've seen Russia step back from that engagement, let's say. So, I think we're still in this state of flux. We still have the danger point, the tipping point in Idlib. When we come to the final push against Idlib, which, as I say, is now the nest of the other terrorist factions that have been funded and incubated in Turkey, financed and armed by the U.S. coalition and the Gulf states, and of course supported down in the south by Israel. And it's also important at this point to note that there has been an ISIS recruitment cell and grouping on the border with Syria and Israel in the illegally annexed Golan Heights. So while the bulk of the ISIS entity within Syria has been defeated, there is still an element of ISIS to the south in the Golan Heights and on the border with Israel. So, you know, I think...
You know, it kind of reminds me of years ago when the Israelis tried to hang on to their little private Lebanese army that they kept along the Lebanese border. Are they going to try to do that here?
I think they are. I mean, you know, throughout this war, really, the terrorist factions, whether you, you know, however, again, you brand them, whether it's the Southern Liberation Front, whether it's the Free Syrian Army, if you call them moderates or extremists, they're still doing the same job, and they are still terrorists, as recognized by the Syrian people as terrorists. But the various groups that have grouped inside the annexed Golan Heights have definitely been working in collusion with Israel. And we know that Israel has been taking them into their hospitals, treating them before releasing them back in Syria to continue fighting and against the Syrian army and its allies and destabilizing Syria and acting as custodial guardians over the Israeli annexed territory within Syria itself. And we've seen, you know, many times that Israel has given covering fire for those factions when they've been fighting the Syrian army. So, and you know, even now we're expecting, because various areas have been taken in the last 24 hours in that area on the border with Israel. So we're sort of expecting an Israeli attack at some point, either on the air bases in Damascus, which is a favored target for them in Mezzeh.
They seem to have been trying to divert occasionally when the Syrian army would be having successes somewhere. They would make a diversion. That is, they would bomb and then hope that there would be some kind of hostilities, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we've seen this. We see this time and time again, and it's also a very familiar tactic by Israel, is not to engage directly on the ground, for example, but to use its long-range missiles or to use its air force to target and leave. In other words, to sort of create or to throw the Syrian Arab Army advances and ammunition supplies off course, to derail them at a moment of intense fighting or intense campaign against terrorist factions. I mean, for example, in the last few days, we've seen an intensification of the bombardment, for example, of Damascus. Now, this is a familiar pattern. When we see the Syrian Arab Army advance towards victory in one area, what we see are the terrorist factions that are embedded, for example, in the suburbs of Damascus, in Ghouta, in Jobar, in Ain Tarma. We see an intensification of the mortar and rocket attacks and explosive bullet attacks, not on the Syrian army, I hasten to add, but on the civilian areas of Damascus itself. I mean, tonight, literally about 2 hours ago, two mortars fell into the judo hall in the Al Fayer Stadium, killing two martyrs who were both on the national judo team. So this is not, you know, this is not a war against an unpopular government. This is a terrorist proxy war against the entire Syrian people, against the entire Syrian nation. And those who suffer whenever the Syrian army makes these advances and cleanses areas of the internationally backed terrorist agents, what we see are the remaining terrorist forces turning on the civilians. Yeah. And this, you know, this has been a pattern of the 7 years.
Yes, it's a sort of a policy of attempted demoralization, or to say, you've defeated us, but we can still hurt civilians.
Yeah,
kind of like a hostage taker.
Absolutely, and you'll see an increase in suicide bombings, for example. You know, I mean, these are typical terrorist activities. We saw it in East Aleppo, for example, before it was liberated in December 2016. Over 11,000 civilians in West Aleppo were murdered by the Western-backed terrorist factions in East Aleppo with mortars and howl canisters, explosive bullets, suicide attacks. So, in other words, you know, the campaign was not against the Syrian army. It was not against the regime, as they call it. Mm-hmm. It was against the civilians. So, yes, it's a form of coercion. It's a form of leverage to try and reduce morale and to turn people against the Syrian government. And, of course, it failed. It failed over 7 years, but not without huge bloodshed, huge mm-hmm. bloodshed in Syria, and it's continuing.
This is Vanessa Bealey. You can find her writing primarily at 21st Century Wire, and also I urge to go to the Twitter account as well. Vanessa, I'm interested in your opinion about all the sort of ramifications of the success of Syria and its allies. And it, now we're seeing people like Barzani suddenly disappears. Mm. We heard there was going to be a Kurdish Syria, and then Mr. Erdogan says today maybe he shouldn't be a member of NATO. Iraq seems not to be listening to Washington. The Prime Minister of Lebanon is ordered to go to Riyadh and is treated like a child. And is this all a connection to their setback after their attempt to overthrow Syria?
I think we're seeing, a fascinating and actually in many ways a very positive, well, hugely positive, reshaping of the global paradigm. We're seeing an alliance now being cemented, which actually seems to consist of, after the various maneuvers and reshuffles that we've seen, I mean, for example, between Saudi Arabia and Qatar, between Turkey and NATO.
Yes, I left out Qatar.
Between, yes, poor Qatar.
Which is big enough.
Exactly. And so now what we almost are seeing is Turkey and Qatar, although obviously, you know, there is an element of distrust within the axis of resistance against them, but nevertheless, they've really practically announced this military alliance, cementing the new resistance axis that includes China, Russia, Iran, so now Turkey, Syria, Lebanon. I mean, you know, these efforts by Saudi Arabia to bring division to Lebanon, of course, fueled by Israel. It's amazing how we now see this alliance between Wahhabism and Zionism.
The Globe and Mail today is reporting that the Israelis are openly talking about their alliance with Saudi Arabia, although they say Saudi Arabia is a little less noisy about this point.
Well, they are, but I mean, it's been very clear for some time now that there's been a huge coming together of these two elements. But you know, it's very clear why. It's against a common enemy, which of course is Iran, Hezbollah, and that brings in the other elements of that axis of resistance. So now we have Turkey and Qatar basically joining the China, Russia, Iran, Syria, Lebanon, Iraq axis, which suddenly forms this very powerful bloc. And the problem is that what's happening now, I mean, Saudi's recent actions, which were intended to bring division to Lebanon, to drive wedges into what has been traditionally quite a sectarian society, and in reality it's had the opposite effect. It's actually brought together all of the political parties saying, no, you know, we don't accept this resignation. Hezbollah are coming forward, you know, with very clear indications that they know what is going on. They're talking about the potential of an assassination attempt on a key or prominent figure in Lebanon to try and, you know, revive sectarian difficulties. So Lebanon is suddenly gelling together against this external threat.
Yes, those and people suddenly, who tried to play the sectarian game have found that the Lebanese no longer accept it. They don't want to be the Sunnis who fight the Shia and this kind of Time magazine scenario. They simply don't accept it.
No, exactly. And we're also seeing the same thing in Iraq, very interestingly. You know, Iraq, I mean, poor Iraq, you know, it's been the target of U.S. imperialism and destabilization for decades now. But we had a meeting very recently in Iraq with the leader of the PMU, Hashad al-Shaabi, which, of course, in the States is known as a terrorist organization. It's under terrorist sanctions. And yet the PMU now is a recognized organization, just as Hezbollah is in Lebanon, by the Iraqi administration. And the Iraqi army and the PMU forces have been fighting together, complementing each other as a defense force against externally backed, foreign-backed terrorist factions against Daesh. So we're seeing this coming together of previously divided factions under the U.S. imperialist pressure to fight the common threat, which is U.S. imperialism, you know, and that involves all of its client states in Israel and the Gulf states and so on. So we're seeing these attempts by Israel, by the United States, by Saudi Arabia to exacerbate any sort of sectarian fault lines. They're failing. And in fact, what's happening is that these nations are ensuring their own isolation. And what is happening is that the bloc itself is not only reinforcing, but it's actually drawing in other members that can see that if they're not careful, they're going to be left very much out on a limb with an ally that is not going to have their back. You know, the U.S. is not known for its...
Not terribly loyal.
No, it's not.
They have a president who brags about not being loyal, so
well,
kind of a problem.
You know, they're opportunists, and the problem is that the Kurds have seen this. You know, that's why Barzani fell apart. That's why the Kurdish referendum fell apart, because basically the Iraqi forces with the PMU mobilized so quickly. And I mean, I met a journalist from Westcott when I was in Iraq, and she said to me, she was embedded with the forces when they went into Kirkuk, and she said, we crossed from one side of Kirkuk to the other in about 10 minutes, she said, because the Peshmerga, the various Kurdish factions, didn't even really, they didn't want to follow Barzani. Barzani has a reputation very much as a sort of mafia leader, opportunist, and the majority of the Kurds, they didn't really want to be involved in the whole Kurdistan issue, which of course again was a creation of the United States when they divided up Iraq in the first place.
Yes, here they had this. They had drawn up a map for us, and we were learning all about our new friend. It was going to be a country, and now it's evaporated and it's no longer discussed in our media here at all. It just disappeared.
No,
it's like never mind that card. We threw it away.
Well, I mean, and this is, I think, you know, Syria is, at huge, huge, huge cost to Syria. But it's been a tremendous litmus paper for the world, because it has exposed the United States for the dishonest, lawless rogue state that it really is on an international stage. It has elevated Russia, although it is a pragmatic international player, it has nevertheless adhered to international law. It appears to believe in the supremacy of law. It has shown itself to be an honest international player. And so therefore, you know, it's completely shifted the global paradigm. And what we're seeing, as I said, is this formation of a bloc behind Russia, and those basically almost deserting the sinking ship, which is the United States.
Yes. And by the way, that bloc is a peace bloc. I mean, they're actually trying to stop all these little fires and wars started by the U.S.
Yeah, well,
so
in fact...
I hope they start calling them the peace bloc. I'm going to nominate them for the Nobel Prize. I know that that's probably unlikely to happen, but...
Well, maybe we should have an alternative peace prize. I've been saying this for some time. But actually, Javad Zarif, the Iranian foreign minister, he tweeted out in the last few hours, working with Turkish and Russian counterparts to build on ceasefire we achieved in Syria and preparing for inclusive dialogue among Syrians. The irony is that Saudi Arabia accuses Iran of destabilization while itself fuels terrorists, wages war on Yemen, blockades Qatar, and foments crisis in Lebanon. I can't say it any more clearer than that. You're absolutely right. It's the peace bloc versus the war bloc and versus the destabilization bloc. And, you know, I think most people now are recognizing that.
Yeah. Well, I thank you very much for all that. We've been speaking to Vanessa Beely, 21st Century Wire, and also Vanessa Beely Twitter, so you can be absolutely up to date. Vanessa, thank you very, very much. We look forward to talking to you soon. I know you've written a long piece about Yemen in 21st Century Wire. I urge everybody to please read that. And in the near future, we hope to talk to you about it.
Well, thank you so much, Bill. Take care.
Okay. Thank you. And that was Vanessa Beely. This is the Taylor Report. I got to remind you, you can find us on Facebook / The Taylor Report. We are The Taylor Report on Facebook. And on SoundCloud, it is Taylor-Report. So on SoundCloud, we have a Taylor-Report. And now in the moments remaining, I just... We could say again here, the passing of Ed Herman, I hope people would turn to his writings. He had an article recently.
He did a 100-year review of anti-Russian revolution and anti-communist propaganda, and it was amazing because he went right back to 1917, and he just talked about over the years things that I had already forgotten.
Oh, you've
about.
Exposed him. He's a Bolshevik and a Russian.
Oh my God! Yeah.
I let it out.
And he pointed out that the campaign of lies is not a recent invention when it comes to going after the Russians. They have a lot of experience doing this stuff and dragging stuff up and making things up and distorting things. And you know,
he
kept a catalog of it. He didn't forget any of it.
The guy was like a detective. Yeah. He was brilliant. And I'm very grateful to him that because of our reporting on the situation in Rwanda, the false narrative around the events of Rwanda in 1994 until today, we've spoken a lot. We've talked to experts of all types. And he and David Peterson wrote a book, The Politics of Genocide. Brilliant, brilliant book, which discusses how the word genocide is put in play by people with bad intentions. And Noam Chomsky speaks of this. This is a very important book, The Politics of Genocide. Please get that book. And I'll tell you, when we were being criticized from some quarters and heavy threats, et cetera, from small people. He sent me a note, and he said, to be accused by a dunce is to wear a crown. from William Blake. And I said, gee, Ed Herman gave me a shot of adrenaline, and I did appreciate it. By the way, another person gave us, we have a listener, Maggie, who sent us a very nice note saying how she thinks we covers matters appropriately and with good humor. And honest to God, that is what we try to do. And so I really appreciate that Maggie wrote to us, and that too put a bounce in our step. This is the Taylor Report. Again, SoundCloud, Taylor-Report, and Facebook / The Taylor Report. Charlotte has done a brilliant job. And we thank, of course, Mel Tillis for being a wonderful guy. And we'll see you next week.